Welcome to Awake versus Aware, which is a presentation that aims to break the illusions of current events, offer tangible solutions, and prompts the listener to keep their hand off the mind break.
Good day and welcome to the Awake versus Aware show, recording on August 2nd, 2025. With us is Kaylee, the co-host, and the illustrious Michael Cremo. Michael Cremo, also known as the Forbidden Archaeologist, is hailed as a groundbreaking research pioneer and international authority on archaeological anomalies. His landmark bestseller, Forbidden Archaeology, first published in 1993, already translated into 26 languages, challenged the very foundation of Darwinian evolution. Michael continues to dig up enigmatic discoveries in the fossil record and quote-unquote shake up accepted paradigms, exploring famous archaeological sites around the world, journeying to sacred places in India, appearing on national television shows in the United States or other countries, lecturing at mainstream science conferences, or speaking to alternative gatherings of global intelligentsia. As he crosses disciplinary and cultural boundaries, he presents to his various audiences a compelling case for negotiating a new consensus on the nature of reality. He is a member of the World Archaeological Congress and the European Association of Archaeologists, as well as a research associate in history and philosophy of science in the, I'm probably going to say this wrong, Bativé, Danta Institute. After receiving a scholarship to study international affairs at George Washington University, Michael began to study the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, known as the Vedas. In this way, he has broadened his academic knowledge with spirituality from the Eastern tradition. Welcome, sir. Thank you for being on the podcast.
Good to be here with all your listeners.
Thank you so much. Yeah, you just had the Extreme Human Antiquity book just released, I believe a month or month and a half ago.
That's right.
Yeah, let's make that the focus here. What is extreme about human antiquity?
Well, if you look in the regular textbooks of archaeology, you'll see that archaeologists say that humans like us have first come into existence on this planet less than 300,000 years ago. But when I looked into the whole history of archaeology, I found that archaeologists and other scientists who dig into the earth have discovered many human bones, human artifacts, and human footprints, showing that human beings like us have existed for many millions of years, tens of millions, even hundreds of millions of years on this planet. So that is the meaning of extreme human antiquity. It means evidence for a human presence on this planet that goes much further beyond the relatively few hundred thousand years that most mainstream archaeologists and other scientists now accept.
Thank you. And what difference does it make if humans have been around for an extremely long time?
Well, one thing that it means, if this evidence is taken seriously, which I think it should be, is that it means we need new explanations for human origins. And I think before we even ask the question, how long have humans been around? Where did we come from? We should first of all ask the question, what is a human being? Now, today, many scientists will say that a human being or any other living thing is just a machine made of molecules. And we're these machines made of molecules are competing with each other for survival. So I don't accept that. I think that A human being is more than just a combination of material elements, chemical elements. There is consciousness, which no scientist has been able to explain how it could possibly come from matter organized in the form of neurons in the brain. I think consciousness has a completely separate existence from matter. It's not that matter produces consciousness. Consciousness has its own independent existence. So ultimately, this is where this evidence for extreme human antiquity leads. It means we need a new sense of who we are and what we are. And that would mean a different set of goals and values that would guide people's lives individually and collectively, because now things are extremely materialistic, and this leads to competition and violence on all levels of human society. It leads to environmental destruction. In other words, it leads to the kind of world we see around us today. And unless we change our sense of identity, of who we are and what we are, it's just going to get worse.
Absolutely, sir. Yeah, one of your most recent interviews you did was with Jimmy Church on YouTube, which fascinating going on to different topics of what you're talking about here, especially with the AI emergence, its hype, and you guys went into pretty, I suppose, extreme topics too with V2K and these other things of dream control and influence, and in terms of forbidden archaeology. And how that all connects, I thought it was really, it was interesting. What inspired research into this topic of forbidden archaeology?
Well, that has something to do with the way I grew up. My father was an intelligence officer in the United States Air Force. So that meant a couple of things for me as I was growing up. One thing it meant we were living in a lot of different places in the United States and around the world. When I was high school age, we were stationed in Germany in a town called Wiesbaden. And there was an American school there for the children of the military officers. And on my vacation, spring vacation, summer vacation, winter break, I would go different places in Europe because I thought I should take advantage of the opportunity. So on one of my vacations, I went to Stockholm and Sweden, and I was staying in a youth hostel there. And I met some young people who had traveled overland to India. You could do that in those days. And they'd come back and they were telling me all kinds of stories about yogis they'd met, what it was like in the Himalayan mountains and Kathmandu or Kashmir or different places like that. And I became interested in studying the culture and especially the literature of the ancient Indian spiritual traditions. And in those writings, I read accounts of human civilizations, human populations that existed in very distant ages, going back millions of years in the Indian cyclical concept of time. And I began to wonder, well, is that just some mythology, or is there perhaps some factual evidence to back it up? These accounts of extreme human antiquity that I found in these writings. And that's what got me looking into the history of archaeology. So that's how I got into the topic. Yeah, at first I thought I would do maybe 8 weeks of research. Maybe I'll find a few interesting facts. I'll write a short article about them. But as I got into it, started digging into it, one case just led to another. And the 8 weeks turned into 8 months, turned into 8 years of research. And I was astonished by the sheer number of discoveries that contradict what we're being told in today's textbooks. So that's kind of how I got into it, and it became sort of a career for me.
Absolutely, sir. Yeah, one of my first exposures to you was on Coast to Coast, your interviews there, and of course the many podcasts you've been on. So with this new book, Extreme Human Antiquity, what is the relation between this and your earlier book, Forbidden Archaeology?
Well, I've always been in a kind of dialogue with my readers. People would read Forbidden Archaeology and they would write to me, have there been any more discoveries like that that you've come across since the original book was published? Like the original book was published in 1993, which is a long time ago. I mean, people are still buying it, but a lot of cases came to my attention after that, and just so many people were asking for more information, I decided I would do it, and I compiled this book, Extreme Human Antiquity, which came out just a while ago.
Thank you, sir. Kalis, did you have any questions for Mr. Cremo?
Sure. Yeah, I've always been, I remember you mentioning just on one of your most recent podcasts, and I think you've echoed this in other shows you've done as well. The sort of, you've highlighted the forbidden aspect of your research and how it's not allowed in academia to be cited by researchers or students. And I ran into this myself when I was in college, and I was curious, if any of that has changed in that realm, if your work has been allowed to be discussed at all. When I was in college, which wasn't, it wasn't too long ago, maybe 10 years, 15 years ago, I cited you several times, and the paper was rejected. And it I was curious if things have changed.
In some ways, yes. Yeah, there's always been three reactions basically from the scientific community to my work. That's because not all scientists are the same. You've got one group that I call the fundamentalist materialist. Yeah, they're very much opposed to everything I say. They don't want to hear it. They don't want anyone else to hear it. They probably wouldn't accept a paper which cited me in any way, what to speak of advocating my point of view. So, yeah, there are scientists like that. That's a substantial fraction of them. But among the archaeologists, at least, there's another group. The first group, they accept their opposition to my work based on some prior commitment they have to a very strict materialism, very strict adherence to the Darwinian theory of human evolution. And it's more or less an ideological position, not as really a purely scientific situation. Now, the second group is more open-minded. They accept the current theories, but for more or less scientific reasons, which means they're willing to consider alternatives if they're presented in terms of documented evidence and good reasoning. So it's scientists in that group who have reviewed my books and said some positive things about them, not necessarily that they agree with me, but they acknowledge some positive aspects of the work. And at least they're willing to listen. And that's an important first step, because if ideas are going to change, then first thing is somebody has to be willing to listen to a new idea. So it's scientists in this group that have also accepted proposals I've made to present reports or papers about my work at mainstream international scientific conferences. I've presented over the years dozens of papers at major international conferences on archaeology, history of science, and consciousness studies, and things of that sort. Actually, in one of my books, My Science, My Religion, is a collection of 24 papers that I presented at mainstream international science conferences. So some of the readers may be interested in having a look at that book. But sometimes my papers get published in peer-reviewed scientific journals or books published by major scientific publishers. So that's a group. Now, among that group, there are a few who actually agree with me. And they're few in number, and sometimes they can't really say so publicly, but they communicate with me in different ways. So, yeah, so that phenomenon of sometimes I call it knowledge filtration, that operates in the world of science, that does come into play. So if I could ask, Kalis, what discipline were you studying?
It was actually just a 101 course. I was studying criminal justice at the time. And
Oh,
I
wow.
took an archaeology course as an elective.
Yeah, forensic archaeology. Good.
And my other question, and absolutely, I think that these types of sciences are like most, I think, are predicated upon like the tombstone mentality. You know, when one generation dies, new ideas are accepted, and so on it goes. I was curious as to your thoughts, and I want to go back to your works with human devolution and the idea of basically receding from a pure state of consciousness to what we have now. And what we see now is we see this incredible transhumanist push towards Ray Kurzweil, what he would call the singularity, and how some of your works regarding human devolution and how that fits with some of these current events.
Well, I think that's a really important question, and it's where forbidden archaeology leads. You know, in forbidden archaeology, I was just talking about stones and bones, but what it leads to is the consideration of consciousness, because Most of the current dominant scientific theories on the origin of life, and especially the human form of life, is based on the idea that consciousness is produced by matter. But I think that's demonstrably not true, because in over the course of hundreds of years, no scientist has been able to demonstrate how consciousness can come from matter. So ultimately, we are not machines made of molecules. We are beings of pure consciousness. I'm a being of pure consciousness. You're a being of pure consciousness. All our listeners are beings of pure consciousness. If we weren't conscious, we wouldn't be having this discussion, and nobody would be listening to it and hearing it. So, sometimes, if you use terminology that's identified with religion, say you talk about the soul, people's minds turn off. They say, okay, that's religion. That requires belief or faith, and I'm not into that. But consciousness, the idea that one is a conscious, individual, personal being, is not a matter of belief. It's the most real fact of our existence. And that leads to the question, well, if we're by nature beings of pure consciousness, what are we doing in the world of matter? Why are we here? And I think the reason for our being here is it's an opportunity to explore the dimensions of consciousness, to raise consciousness to a level where it won't be limited by the nature, the temporary nature of the material bodily vehicle that the conscious self now occupies. These vehicles that we call bodies are temporary. They come into existence at a certain point in time, and shortly thereafter, they come to an end. But consciousness does not come to an end. Either it will take on another bodily vehicle made of matter, or it will raise its consciousness to a level where it doesn't have to be embodied in a material vehicle. It'll be on some timeless level of awareness or consciousness. So that is the actual purpose of the human form of life. That is the purpose of this whole cosmos that we're in. It's like a virtual reality system that we are meant to draw some lessons from. We can either do two things: become more and more deeply involved in the artificial or simulated reality that's provided to us by material experience, or we can transcend to the level of pure consciousness. That choice is always there. So I think in terms of modern developments in IT and artificial life, artificial intelligence, and so on, science is actually converging in a way upon the actual truth, because they think now we're gaining the ability to not only monitor brain waves and things like that, but modify them, control them. Now they'll never get it exactly right because they're missing some pieces of the puzzle, and they're never going to get it right. But I find it interesting that they're converging on the actual situation because we all right now have some artificial intelligence and we're living an artificial kind of life in an artificial or simulated reality, which is where modern technology is heading. They're trying to embed us all in a digital world where we're subject to the influence and control of whoever's working that system. But that's actually our situation at the present moment. If we were on the level of pure consciousness, we wouldn't require any bodily vehicle. It's because we're not at the moment qualified to exist on that level of pure consciousness. We are in another place. And in that place, the world of matter, we need a vehicle made of matter in which to function. And we identify with that vehicle. Now, for example, if I'm an American man, I identify that that's who I am, that's what I am. But really, I'm something different. I'm kind of a being of pure consciousness with a form that could exist, a personality that could exist on an entirely different level. But because I'm not on that level, I'm identifying with a vehicle made of matter that can function in the world of matter. So I've got a false conception of myself. I've got a false conception of where I am. And that isn't going to lead to any good result. So we ultimately, as beings of pure consciousness, want to free ourselves from identification with a false, temporary, material, bodily vehicle and trying to use that vehicle to get happiness in a false world made like a simulated reality. So we're kind of in the situation. We're in the matrix, you could say, even right now, before. But, modern science and technology is kind of converging on that. But whatever it is, as beings of pure consciousness, we want to rise above it.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Wonderful, so wonderful, but
Go ahead, Mark.
I discovered your work about 25 years ago, and it definitely springboarded me, because me and Kalis here shared that, and even applied of consciousness being foundational to where, going into lucid dreaming and even lucid waking of this waking up in this matrix, and that's why we have the show, the name of it, Awake versus Aware. Have you had any instances or experiences of awakenings, different states of consciousness? Because it does, we get that experience of the life's multidimensionality, that this three-dimensional plane isn't all that there is, and to where, like, even simply in lucid dreaming, like, that reality is so much more alive and just more real in some cases.
Yes, I've had such experiences. As I was explaining earlier, that my work in forbidden archaeology was inspired by my studies in the Vedic literature of ancient India. Well, I also became interested in the spiritual practices that came out of that part of the world. And I became a practitioner of Bhakti Yoga, which is a yoga system that's based on raising consciousness to the level of pure consciousness. So, and in that level, like we can experience the reality that is reflected on the material level. Say, like if you have a fruit tree standing on the bank of a lake, and the tree is reflected in the water. Say it's a mango tree or an apple tree. The fruit will be reflected in the water. And if you think that the reflection in the water is the only reality and you reach for the fruit, you don't get it. You just get a handful of water, which is basically the paradigm of material existence. We're looking for happiness, but we only get the illusion of it. Now, the reflection of the tree implies the existence of a real tree with real fruit on it that you can actually taste. So to do that, one has to understand the difference between the reflection and the reality. And that's the purpose of meditation and yoga, is to detach ourselves from the reflection of reality, the reflection of happiness, and achieve the reality of it. So, in my practice of bhakti yoga, which involves meditation on mantras and other activities, I have experienced what you might call awakening or awareness of being from ultimately a different level of reality. So that has been there. And part of the practice of bhakti yoga means using whatever talent or ability that one has for a higher purpose. So I've always had some talent, maybe not very great talent for writing and speaking. So I regard that, just like what we're doing now, I regard as part of my practice of bhakti yoga. And it, I get flashes of awareness and awakeness in conversations like the one that we're having right now. To me, that is an experience. I've had other experiences too, at different, sacred places that I've gone to in India and other parts of the world. You get some sense that that the sacred place is like a portal to another dimension of reality. And I've had some experiences that kind of fall under the category of what people would call paranormal experiences. Like I've had experiences with remote viewing, and I had an out-of-body experience once. So, yeah, I really like the title of the show, Awake and Aware. That's very significant.
Thank you, sir. Kalis, did you want to add anything to that? I mean, that's, yeah, can be a pretty heavy topic, but you've experienced some of these things yourself.
Oh, absolutely. It's layers upon layers. It's all vibration, it's all energy, it's all stillness, and you experience all three of these things all at once. And I was curious. My main question is with this sort of practice, which has brought you all kinds of extraordinary personal experiences, how have these personal experiences tied into your writing and your works?
Well, I regard the writing as part of my practice of yoga and meditation. To me, in order to, for me, in order to write, I have to go into practically what you would call a state of trance. I have to really meditate deeply to find the words and the manner of expressing those words in such a way that it will have some positive impact for me and for anyone who wishes to get something from those words. I think people get books or read things because they have some expectation that some need of theirs for knowledge or enlightenment, they're going to get some benefit from it. So to do so, this has influenced my writing, and I regard that as a kind of fine-tuning of consciousness to that allows me to have the proper intuition how to structure a work. If you have a book, you have to have a plan for it. How you're going to organize it, what you're going to include in it, how you're going to express it. So those things, I think, come from intuition. Intuition being a word for connecting with some higher intelligence that assists one in coming to the proper way of expressing some truth for my own benefit, for my own purification, and hopefully for the benefit of others as well.
Thank you, sir. Now you just spoke to the aware portion of awake versus aware. Much appreciated. You got any questions, Mark?
Let's get back to the new book, ExtremeHumanAntiquity.com. That you kind of already answered this, but maybe something more specific. Are scientists deliberately concealing evidence?
In some cases, yes, but in many cases, not. There's this process of knowledge filtration that I mentioned, and it's very effective. A person will go to school, maybe they're interested in something like archaeology, and they'll go to school and they'll be told, well, here's the evidence. Here's what our conclusion is. And it all appears to match, So they accept these ideas and say maybe they're working in a museum or they're teaching in a school, say, working in a museum. And maybe they'll hear something from a student. Well, Michael Cremo says, there are these discoveries in this museum that show a very, very ancient human presence. And why aren't they on display? And why aren't they? And the scientists, the archaeologists will think, well, I don't know. There can be some cases that raise some questions, but I'm sure if I went to my colleague down the hall, he'd be able to explain it to me. So, I'm a very busy man here at the museum, and I've got artifacts to catalog and research requests to fulfill, and in other words, he doesn't think he's hiding true evidence, which if people knew about, would cause them to disbelieve in the dominant theories, his theories. He's just thinking, I'm being a responsible scientist, So, no, they don't necessarily think that they're hiding evidence from the public. They just think, well, I'm just being a responsible person. So, but there are some cases in which I think there is or has been deliberate suppression of evidence. But in many cases, it's a more subtle thing. It's not like a satanic conspiracy. It's just that this is how these people had been trained, and they don't see themselves as hiding anything. But the effect is just the same as if it had been a deliberate conspiracy. I mean, I'm not the first person who's pointed these things out. It's something that philosophers of science and historians of science have known about for many, many years. It's that theoretical preconceptions can influence how a scientist will respond to different categories of evidence that come to their attention. This was especially promoted by Dr. Thomas Kuhn, who is the author of a very influential book, The Study of Scientific Revolutions. And he's the one who popularized the term paradigm and paradigm shift. A paradigm in a scientific discipline is the general consensus understanding of authorities in a particular field about the important questions in their discipline, what the answers to those important questions are, what their methodology is, what their epistemology is, in other words, what they consider to be the standards for accepting or rejecting evidence. So, if there's evidence that supports or goes along with or conforms to the dominant paradigm, it passes through this knowledge filter very easily. But if you have cases, evidence that radically contradicts the paradigm, those are considered anomalies. They're set aside, ignored, forgotten, or sometimes, dismissed on very flimsy grounds. So it's not that I'm saying something new. It's something that's very well understood in the world of history and philosophy of science. But the effect of this kind of knowledge filtering is just the same as if it were evidence that was being deliberately suppressed by some kind of conspiracy. So I think it's important for students in these different disciplines to be aware of all of the facts that are relevant to their field of study. Because something that doesn't make sense today may make sense in the light of future discoveries. So,
Yeah, absolutely, sir. What is one of the most, or more than one, of the most fascinating anomalous discoveries?
well, there's, to me, what's really important is not one or two discoveries that are very interesting, because in that case, archaeologists could say, okay, you got a couple interesting cases there, but the vast majority of evidence supports our point of view. So they say that's one thing that they say. But to me, what was really striking is not that there's one or two interesting cases that happen to contradict the current dominant theories. To me, the most important thing was the sheer quantity of cases. Like Forbidden Archaeology, the book was 900 pages long. Sometimes people would call it forbidding archaeology because it just looked too heavy to pick up. But there were literally hundreds of cases of anomalous discoveries there. And in the new book, it's about 450 pages, about half the size of Forbidden Archaeology. And it's also got dozens and dozens of cases. So that's what was most important to me. But now, among the different cases, I do have some of my favorites. One of them being the California gold mine discoveries. In the 1850s, gold was discovered in central California in the Sierra Nevada Mountains. And miners came there to get the gold, and they were digging tunnels into the sides of mountains like Table Mountain near Sonora in the Sierra Nevada Mountains in California. And in these tunnels, the miners were finding human bones, human artifacts, and layers of rock that modern geologists consider to be about 50 million years old. So these discoveries came to the attention of Dr. J.D. Whitney, who was the chief government geologist of California, and he collected them. He did his own research. He published a massive study about them that came out from Harvard University. But we don't hear very much about these discoveries today because of the process of knowledge filtration. There was another scientist, Dr. William Holmes, a physical anthropologist at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, and he wrote, if Dr. Whitney had understood the theory of human evolution, he wouldn't have announced the conclusions that he did. In other words, if the evidence contradicts the dominant paradigm or dominant theory, it can't possibly be true. So the evidence was basically forgotten. But the artifacts are still there in the Museum of Anthropology at the University of California at Berkeley, and the mines where they were discovered are still there in the Sierra Nevada Mountains. So, very interesting set of discoveries that was rejected just because it contradicted the dominant paradigm. So that's one case. And then recently, more in the new book, there's a case from the Jurassic period where a dinosaur bone with cut marks on it that are judged to be butchering marks on dinosaur bone. That's an interesting case because that's over 100 million years old from the Jurassic period. So those are some interesting cases. There are many others as well.
Definitely. Yeah, with the websites given earlier in the show. And also in extremehumanantiquity.com, the first 100 orders placed can get a free pass to the webinar of the book. And details are in the website there. Supporting Mr. Cremo here, it's $35, 434 pages, and just a treasure trove of knowledge, information, and this lost history. Kalis, did you want to add anything?
Well, I do have one question. I was hoping Mr. Cremo might add from his own spiritual side and his own experiences with some of the Eastern traditions. I was curious as to what your opinion is as to what the physical body holds, as to the value of the human body holds to consciousness.
Yes, that's an excellent question. There is a kind of evolution that takes place for the conscious self in the material world. It's not the evolution of one gross physical body to another, like Darwin was proposing. And his followers were proposing that the bodies of ancient apes turned into some type of creature intermediate between the apes and modern humans, and then gradually those intermediates turned into modern humans. I think all those different bodily vehicles have always been available for conscious selves. What's really evolving is the conscious self over a process of transmigration from one body to another. According to one's state of consciousness, one gets a particular type of material bodily vehicle that will allow one to fulfill one's desires. So, what evolves is the conscious self. It goes through different species until it gets to the human form. The human form is special because the human bodily vehicle has the intelligence to understand the kinds of things that we're talking about, the difference between the conscious self and the mechanism of the physical body. Like we say, oh, this is my hand, this is my leg, this is my foot, this is my head, this is my, we understand on some deep level that's reflected in our language that we are not the body. We say, it is my body. Well, who is the I? That is the conscious self. We also have a mental body. And we say, today I am happy, today I am sad, today I am frustrated, today I am angry, today I am feeling peaceful and satisfied. My mind is agitated, my mind is calm. So again, we have to ask ourselves, well, does that mean we're different than our minds? And my answer is yes. Because we say, I feel my mind is calm. But who is the I? That is, that subject, that individual, personal, conscious subjectivity is the actual self, not the mind, not the gross physical body. So it's only in the human form of life that those distinctions can be appreciated and acted upon. Like we're not seeing a lot of animals coming and listening to this program and this discussion and following it. So the human bodily vehicle is very rarely attained. It's like, if you start counting the number of different bodily forms that are available, from the body of an amoeba to a plant to an animal, dinosaur, human being, humans are in a minority. So most conscious cells are not in human bodies. They will evolve through the different kinds of bodily vehicles until they eventually get a human body, which is a kind of special body because it's in the human bodily form that a conscious self can be freed from its contact with matter and elevate itself to the level of pure consciousness, where it exists in harmony with all other beings of pure consciousness and the source of all beings of pure consciousness. So that human bodily vehicle is very rarely achieved, and it's very, very important. So, for the reasons that I've explained, but like you have to have a proper license to have it. So, if you have your human bodily vehicle, you have it, the human form of life, and you misuse it, just like if you take a car and you drive it while you're drunk and you cause danger to yourself and to others or injury. Your license for that vehicle will be taken away. So it's a big responsibility to have this human bodily vehicle, and it should be used for the proper purpose. If it's misused, then we may not have a human body in the next embodiment that will follow this one. And all that depends upon the state of one's mental body.
Thank you, sir. I assume a lot of this is covered in Human Devolution and My Science, My Religion, or which of your books detail more of these concepts?
Human devolution. And if one wants to go back to original Sanskrit texts, Bhagavad Gita is an excellent one.
Thank you. Yeah, this was a question I was trying to think how to ask you, because one of them was, what do you think of immortality? But you've already detailed that in a way through your description of pure consciousness and this hierarchy. But because I've always taken, and Kayla shares this with me, that aging is a disease and that we should choose when we desire to leave the body and not be, these so-called natural processes of things breaking down. And even the practice of Shivambhu Shastra, if I'm saying that right, I've used to counter different ailments, and something as readily available to us that most people don't know that does reverse aging and so much more, counteract pretty much almost everything. What is your opinion of staying in the bodily vehicle? By choice, rather than succumbing to these things that are quote unquote natural deaths, or outside of transhumanism, like there are some natural approaches, like peptides that are coming up that are natural from animals and even synthetic versions. But yeah, I just was curious your take on that.
Well, it's a complicated issue, and I think a lot depends on the individual, what they're comfortable with, and so on. But traditionally, and if you look at the history of the yoga systems in India, there were yogis who would be able to leave their bodily vehicles at will. But this depended upon a very strict practice of being able to raise the conscious self through the life airs in the body, through the different chakras or centers of air circulation in the body, up from the basal level, up to the heart level, up to the head, and then exit the conscious self through what's called the Brahmarundram and voluntarily leave their material bodies. Sometimes it's also described in terms of merging the different elements of the body. The body is made of earth, water, fire, air, and the yogis would be practiced to merge those elements of the body with the reservoirs of those elements, and then the subtle body of mind, intelligence, and ego, they would also merge into the reservoirs of those elements, and then the pure conscious self, the Atma, they would journey to either higher planets or where they would take on bodies of what are called like demigods or rishis or sages, or attain their original forms of pure consciousness on that level of reality. But the main thing is the state of consciousness at the time of leaving the bodies. For different reasons, in terms of the time cycles of the Vedic cosmology, the present age is not really conducive to the type of yoga practice that yogis in previous ages would use to voluntarily depart from their material bodies. The important thing in the present age, which is very disturbed, it's not like a very peaceful kind of world that we live in, but the main thing is the state of the mental body at the time the conscious self departs from the gross physical body. So it's recommended that one meditate on the real nature of the self, meditate on powerful mantras, so that at the time of death, one can be conscious and not in a, you could say, a drugged state.
Definitely, sir. And you've given us those resources. Kalis, did you have anything else to add?
No, I think that hit it right. That hit the nail right on the head.
Thank you. And let me go over where people can reach you. Mcremo.com, myscience.myreligion.com, forbiddenarchaeologist.com, humandevolution.com, forbiddenarchaeology.com, extremehumanantiquity.com. And for people who want to contact you, the contact information is there. And then your social media is facebook.com/MichaelCremo. It's really me. And I think this would be a good place to conclude the interview. Mr. Cremo, did you want to add anything else as far as promoting the new book, resources, anything?
Well, just to repeat the offer that you read, The first 100 people that get Extreme Human Antiquity, my latest book from my website, the one extremehumanantiquity.com, they'll have a free offer for them to hear a webinar about the book.
Thank you. And thank you for being on our show. It was extreme honor, very informative. And yeah, you give so much treasures for free to the public. And thank you so much.
Okay, great. Maybe we'll have a chance to talk again sometime.
Absolutely. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Goodbye.
Good evening.
Mr. Cremo, before you go,
Okay.
I was your works opened my eyes to a lot as far as academia was concerned, and I really appreciate the fact that you took the time to talk to us.
Yeah. I'm happy to do it. Nice to meet both of you.
And I hope you come back.
Okay.
Thank you, sir.
Good night.
You have been listening to Awake versus Aware, a production of CosmicReality.com. Thank you for listening.